And we should be going live. I'm just going to refresh this. And we're off. Hello there in the chat, everybody. I'll just see if my guy in the, is in the chat there and I'm coming through okay. Here we go. There he is. That's my little sign there. And welcome back. Welcome back, everybody, to another cozy Morgothan and Dawa's classic movie stream. Leave your troubles outside. Leave all the misery of the world. And we're going to take a deep dive into a great classic old movie with a load of good stuff in it. How we doing, Endeavor?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I just spent the last couple days, swimming through the filth with that latest video that I posted on my channel, which is actually doing surprisingly well. You know, you got to confront the realities of the world, but at the same time, you can't just constantly be despairing all day long. So you got to also take some time to, maybe step back from it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to add a caveat in this as well. So we did quite a bit of soul searching behind the scenes about whether to actually host this on YouTube or maybe it would have to be recorded and or an Odyssey special or something like that. Because of certain kinds of social commentary, and I'm going to stay well away from that. And then when I watched it again and started doing my notes, I thought, you don't really have to worry about it. It's the more social justice angle type commentary on this. It comes in on the later movies and the remakes. And it seems like when you get closer to the modern age, they've got more... it's more of a politically correct slant in it, and this one it's not really that pronounced so much. So I can see the comments in the chat there. I think everybody understands we've got to be careful about some of these issues. So what was your take, and had you seen it before, The Planet of the Apes?
No, it was the first time I had seen the original. I saw the most recent one, which was the third out of a trilogy that came out a couple of years ago. But that was the only one, that was the only Planet of the Apes movie I had ever seen. We need to get into that one. But yeah, it was the first time I saw it. I thought it was quite good. You know, I thought that there was actually quite a few deep messages in there that are interesting to get into. You can definitely see where they were going with it with, well, we'll get into this with several of the debates that went on. And you know, I do think there's a lot of good takes that you can derive from it. So I enjoyed it. It was a good sci-fi adventure film.
I love it. I love it. And I love so much about it. And maybe it's one of those things because it's like the kind of movie that you grew up with. When I was a kid at me grandparents, it would be on like on a Saturday afternoon or something. And there's a funny thing because I watched the new Dune. I'm not going to get carried away on a whole other sci-fi universe, but just in terms of the movie making, I just found that everything looks great, everything looks wonderful, but there's some kind of spark missing, you know. And like I could go 15 years without watching like Planet of the Apes, and I'd still remember some of the lines and some of the bits in it. And when you watch it again, you realize that you've seen so much of it in memes and in quotes and all of this. People using the famous ending. By the way, like, spoiler alert, they're on Earth all the way along.
Yeah, I just before we start, I will say that the spoilers, the twist at the end was really obvious. Like, they're on another planet, but there's also humans. They also speak English, American English from the 20th century. You know, yeah. I mean,
everybody speaks English except for the humans. But what I mean is that the funny bit. I mean, I'm getting carried away with all my favorite Charlton Heston bits because I absolutely love Charlton Heston. This because he is like this cynical. He's a bit of a bastard. He's really cynical, and he's got this, I don't know, he's got this nasty streak to him. And do you know the gif that goes around where people use it now, and it's him laughing, and the camera does this thing where it sort of goes above his head Do you know which one I mean? He's got this big kind of, he's just laughing away, and then the camera goes off up onto the sky. And you see it on the internet all the time. And the thing is, what he's actually laughing at there. So it's right at the start, and they land on what they think it's 700 years in the future, and they think they're on this far distant planet. And basically, he's telling the other two astronauts that they're screwed; they're never going to go back. And one of the astronauts is having a bit of a panic, and he's moaning on, and he's saying, "Oh, I'm never going to see the wife again. Everybody I know is dead, and we're never going to go back to Earth." And Charlton Heston just shows him no compassion whatsoever. Like, he's really rubbing the salt in, and it's called, like, he's saying that you're never going to see any of them again, and he thinks it's funny. And he says, if you're lucky, maybe they'll erect like a statue of you. But by now, the statue will already have rusted. Nobody's going to remember your name. There's going to be not a trace of you left. So, like, get used to it, buddy, because that's the situation. And then a little bit later, you see the same astronaut plants a little American flag, as if to say, well, at least we made it here. And that is the bit when Charlton Heston's just laughing. He's just laughing at how naive it is. He's got like the streak of being a total bastard in it, and I think it's just great. And this is what's missing, you know, even with the weird camera shot thing of him laughing and all of the one-liners that he comes out with, these great lines that he comes out with in the film. And you watch something like in June, and there's none of that in it. And I mean, leaving aside the diversity quotas and all of that, just the sort of the way the characters behave and what they say, they don't have. It's as if it's all been like sort of approved by the committee, and so it's like all of the little sort of odd bits that make people charismatic and interesting, that's all been kind of cut out. And you end with this real kind of blandness. And yet they've put so much work into the special effects, the grand vistas. Whereas in this, I mean, I will say that I think for the opening 20 minutes, they're just walking around like Arizona or somewhere. But the thing is, what it does great is that it does actually feel like an alien planet. Because it's that well done, the camera angles are a little bit off kilter. So even though like it is just in America somewhere, like it does actually feel like an alien planet.
Yeah, definitely. I do love the opening shots of the canyon and the mountains that they're climbing up over. I don't know. There's something about like this like masculine blonde haired, blue eyed guy like waltzing around the desert that just seems like so cool, you know. And you know, Charlton Heston is always, he's like, you know, the all American hero kind of type. He was in quite a few movies where he played that kind of hero. I guess what we can start with is his character in particular. And, what I wanted to talk about first was that, the opening monologue of the movie. So the opening monologue, is of Charlton Heston saying that he's leaving the, 20th century behind because they go through this time loop where, like, it's a year and a half that passes in their time, but in Earth hours, thousands of years have passed. So he's basically giving this monologue in the ship's log to send it out to whoever is listening, saying he's leaving the 20th century behind. He has no regrets, and he's off to discover a new world. He's off to see what no man has ever seen before. And, you know, it really reminded me of what I'm currently reading right now, Oswald Spengler. I'm currently making my way through The Decline of the West. And one thing that Spengler talks about throughout the book is the Faustian culture, the Faustian spirit. And I know you probably know a lot more about it than I do, but what Spengler defines the Faustian culture as is infinite space, the drive towards the infinite, always finding new frontiers to go towards. You know, like he uses the example of the American the American plains, so the drive across America as very Faustian. I think that when this movie was released in the late 60s, this was the height of the space race. So it came out in 1968. It was 1 year before Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. So this is kind of the height of where of the infinite space that Faustian man ventured into, because, you know, since then, the space exploration really hasn't been what it was back then. But I find that Charlton Heston's character really embodies that kind of spirit that would have been commonplace in the United States, especially in the late 60s. Is that, you know, we're venturing off into the new frontier. We're going off into space. We're going to find new worlds. And, you know, Planet of the Apes is a film that really kind of, really captures that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the backdrop is throughout the whole film is the space race and the Cold War and the threat of nuclear Armageddon. It's weird because in terms of a Spenglerian cycle, you're going from the end of one, which would be the sort of the descent into this like technological, there's no brakes on anything anymore, and the world ends. But then into the like the pre-culture of the next civilization, like a sort of transition there. And what's makes it so interesting is that Charlton Heston and the two astronauts, well, Charlton Heston, let's be honest, the others don't last very long, but Charlton Heston like sort of straddles both, and that's where you get the kind of the confusion. He straddles the pre-culture phase of the ape world and like the end of the human one, the you know what I mean?
Yeah, and what I wanted to say about him in terms of like his character at the beginning of the film, how he's really cynical, you know, he laughs in Landon's face when he plants the American flag on the ground, you know, I find that a lot of kind of his cynicism and a lot of his arrogance is at least at the beginning of the film, because he changes, but it's the result of kind of being on top in the world that he's from. So in the 1960s, America was on top of the world. It was the most powerful country the world had ever seen. And Charlton Heston's character was an alpha Chad in this world. So, you know, for him, it's really hard to envision yourself as anything other than sitting on top of the world, as being the alpha of all of mankind, or, you know, all of the universe in this sense, in this case. But then what you see is throughout the film, he really does start to actually care about humanity. Like at the very end of the film, he asks to have the provisions for him and Nova to go off and you know, presumably start a new human society. That doesn't actually happen in the sequels, but he's like very insistent on that. Like, whereas at the beginning, he really just like couldn't care less. Like, he mocks Landon by saying, "You're the last of the line. Everyone you know is dead. It's all over." But he really gains an appreciation for really just how delicate human civilization is. Like, for example, there's the at the beginning of the movie, the female they brought with them, which, by the way, I also wanted to point out that if they were going to try to populate this new world, they probably should have brought a lot more females than males. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. She dies because her container that they're being preserved in, it cracks and there's a leak and she dies in her sleep. So the only female doesn't make it. And, you know, that would mean that it would be the end of the human race. And like Charlton Heston at the beginning, he thinks it's hilarious, but at the end, when they're escaping, when Cornelius and Zira are breaking him out of the ape compound, he insists that Nova be brought with them. This is the human who can't speak, but, you know, she's given to Charlton Heston. He's given to Taylor, the name of the character, as his mate, and he insists that she come with him because that's kind of like the key to starting a new humanity.
And I mean the plan that they had was a bit weird, so, and Charlton Heston even kind of makes a joke about it where there's three men and one woman, and he even says like she was going to be like getting a lot of our attention or something like that. It's as if he's pointing out like how ridiculous the plan was. And Nova, of course, she's gorgeous in it. I mean, she's running around in a little loincloth, like a sort of caveman bikini type thing the whole way through. And she doesn't speak either. But it's so funny the way Charlton Heston just like lays claim to her. She can't speak and she doesn't seem to have any agency whatsoever. And she just gets dragged along behind Charlton Heston on his horse all of the time. It's great. It's great stuff. Like, I mean, I love, I mean, I know that people in the chat were saying, about the famous line about get your damn dirty paws off me, your damn earbud, or what that line was. But my favorite line, just to sort of wrap up these how awesome Charlton Heston is and this, my favorite line is when they go to the cave at the end, and it's Roddy McDowell. I mean, we can get it, it's interesting to have a look at the apes and everything, and because they've got their own like sort of hierarchy. But there's a bit at the end when it's Roddy McDowell and the chimpanzee, Zira, and Roddy McDowell, the male ape, who's kind of her husband, they're more like liberals. The chimpanzees in the ape world tend to be more liberal. And the orangutans are sort of like old. They are like intellectuals, and they're very conservative. And a big thing of the story is that the science and the religion is kind of, you know, is gatekept by the same set of orangutans. And then you've got the gorillas, and they tend to be the military and the police, like the muscle. But one little bit that I love is where there's like a shootout happening at the cave, and Roddy McDowell is like, "Oh, Taylor, stop it. You're surrounded. You're surrounded. Just put the gun down and there'll be no more bloodshed." And Taylor turns around and just says, "Shut up!" And he's just constantly being like a total chad and slapping people around. I mean, he does get a lot of shit. It seems like every 5 minutes, like his throat and neck really get some grief. It's as if every 5 minutes he's being choked and dragged around on a lead, and all, he gets shot in the neck as well. But he's, they can't control him. And by the end, you do see that actually the Dr. Zeus is actually kind of correct, because he is terrified of Charlton Heston. And he says, like, Heston says, like, Taylor says, like, "You're terrified of me and you hate me, but I don't understand why." And Dr. Zeus says, "Because you're a man, because I know what you're capable of." Well, this opens up the whole sort of the deep lore, kind of the most interesting aspects of it, I think. But Charlton Heston's just fantastic in this.
So I think that the main dynamic is the kind of the science versus religion dynamic. And, you know, I think that what's really interesting about this film is it does actually like play to a lot of liberal liberal mentality of the time of the 60s. But it is kind of like a bait and switch at the end. Like I think that the ending of them, it turning out that they're on Earth, I think that's kind of just, it was a bit obvious, but I think that what is really interesting though, is the way that they kind of flip this dynamic on its head. So the characters of Cornelius and Zira, they're the two apes who are they're the scientists, and they Cornelius has a theory that apes are evolved from man, and that man had a society that was more advanced than them thousands of years earlier. And I think it's Zira that has the theory that man is intelligent. He can be trained to be capable and to be civilized. And they find Taylor, and Taylor's kind of like the missing link, as they would say, in Darwinian terms. He's the missing link that proves that that Cornelius's theory is true. But what they find throughout the movie is that they're absolutely terrified of the religion of the ape society. So Dr. Zeus, who is they say, one, there's a great line at the end that he says, like, he's the chief minister of science, but also the defender of the faith. And Dr. Zeus says that there's no contradiction between the two, and we'll get into him later. But they basically find that their theories about apes and about man and about evolution, they're all heretical. Now, obviously, this is a parable for Darwinism and things like the Scopes monkey trial. I think that's kind of what that courtroom scene was based on. But what you see later in the film is that this really gets turned on its head toward the end. And there's a lot to say about it. So would you like to add anything to that?
Well, yes, because it's, again, you go back to the Zira. Roddy McDowell is an architect, and he's been out in. So they've got the Forbidden Zone, and they've created this kind of mythos that the Forbidden Zone is poisonous and that there's unknown things lurking there. They're talking about how dangerous it is. They're telling everybody, all like within the ape society, they're telling everybody that you'll die if you go there. And they've got like scarecrow things there. And it's like, again, the film's so well done that you do actually feel that sense of foreboding. But for one reason or another, it amounts to the fact they don't want the people, like the apes, wandering in there and poking around. But for some reason, because it's the plot needed it, Roddy McDowall has been in there. And he's, again, you get this idea that the chimpanzees are liberal progressives. In like the larger sense, not like sort of moron SJWs, you know, that they're kind of Richard Dawkins types or something, and they are going in there and they are, well, you could say that they're like a big sort of real liberals, sort of British imperialist kind of liberals, and they are going in there and Roddy McDowall's actually found some artifacts from in a cave from long, long ago. And when you go down, it's like the thing with the dinosaurs, where the dinosaur and that, at what level were they born and buried. And so he's discovered that it doesn't make sense because he's found like human artifacts and they're buried way down deeper than the more primitive ape ones, which are higher up. So it's like, well, this suggests that like the humans were there first. And the problem they have is that their whole religion, their whole society is based on the idea that apes descended from humans descended from apes, or apes descended from humans. Which way around is it?
Their idea is that humans were descended from apes.
Yes. So they come first. Yeah. So it's an inversion of like the normal Darwinian argument. It's that, but turned upside down. And of course, like the sort of the all of the arguments that happened here in the West with Christianity, you can see that someone like Dr. Zaius, he comes across at first as a sort of you know, like this kind of, as if he's weak, as if his ideas about the world are too stuffy and too conservative, and the Zira and the chimp and Roddy McDowall, the chimpanzees, are kind of saying you're going to have to move with the times, and that you're going to have to accept that like scientific truths. But what he actually knows things which are like more important than what they are, and he's kind of vindicated at the end because he understands that if they start poking around in this with this forbidden knowledge, the foundations of their civilization will begin to unravel, and that will lead them on the road to hell. And on top of that, he can see also that humans did go down that road and it ended up destroying them. So he's actually in he's got a more powerful argument. I mean, what I'll say as well, like, is the ape society, they've got a golden rule, which is that ape shall not kill ape. Now, this is a bit pushed to the limit because Dr. Zaius does say, like, if you keep carrying on shoving guns in my face, you'll hang. But by and large, and it repeats across all of these different Planet of the Apes movies and reboots, that the idea is that they won't be like the humans, because what they'll say about the humans is that they'll kill each other and kill everybody else. That's what humans do. And so the golden rules of the Ape Society is that they don't kill each other as well. So that there's really a lot, like, it's deceptive. It's intellectually deceptive, this movie, because it kind of throws a curveball at you. And I'll just say as well, like, this is what good science fiction is supposed to do. Good science fiction is supposed to leave you scratching your head and think, well, I hadn't considered it from that point of view before.
Yeah, so I actually had the same assessment of people like Cornelius and Zira. They were kind of like the Ape Society's Richard Dawkins. They believe in what we'd call today scientism, and you know, a pre let's just say current year disease thingy. This is kind of a scientism from before that, whereas today, you know, it's a religion of its own. But it's kind of this like enlightenment liberalism. It's this materialistic, atheistic way of looking at the world where you view empiricism and the scientific method as the ultimate pathway to truth. And scientism is openly hostile to religion, as you can see with people like Dawkins. They view tradition and religion and myth as kind of these backward superstitions, which are holding back progress. And they kind of view Dr. Zayas as someone like maybe Ken Ham, you know, like one of the guys like with the Creationism Museum or some like kind of, you know, one of the kind of evangelical fundamentalists that someone like Christopher Hitchens would debate in the 90s. And I guarantee you that, you know, some idiot like Thunderfoot or The Amazing Atheist will watch Planet of the Apes and think that it's a atheistic film, that it's pro, that it's backing up their worldview when it really isn't. Because Dr. Zayas is actually, he's actually more like someone like G.K. Chesterton. There's a famous saying from G.K. Chesterton. What he said was that if a wise man is walking and he comes across a fence, instead of tearing down the fence, he asks, why is the fence there to begin with? So you can look at the apes' myths. So they're myths about things like about man, how they believe man is the devil's pawn and that he's totally evil and he can never be welcome in ape society. And things like the Forbidden Zone, like you're just not allowed to go there because there's some like mysterious metaphysical wickedness out in the Forbidden Zone. Like Cornelius even says at one point, like when Taylor asks him, why is it the Forbidden Zone? He says, I don't know, it's just forbidden. So he really doesn't understand. Cornelius really doesn't understand why it's forbidden. But what's really interesting, though, is that what would be the ape society's version of the Chestertonian fences is this relationship with man. It's allowing man to actually, it's like, you know, like taking your foot off of man's neck for one moment. He's going to, their myth, their traditional wisdom that's been passed down from generations tells them that this is what will happen if we ever allow man into human society, ape society rather. And what you see at the end is that kind of man's advances, like man's nature destroyed the planet, because you find out at the end that human society was destroyed in a nuclear war. The famous scene at the very end where Taylor comes across the Statue of Liberty. And there actually is a lot of wisdom in someone like Dr. Zayas, because he understands, like at the very end, he admits to Cornelius that, yes, the things that you're saying are true. It is true that there was a man society that existed before us. It is true that it was more advanced than ours. But in order to prevent our world from being destroyed, we have to never allow man to ever rise again. And you know, they use this kind of myth as what, you know, one of these fences that Chesterton would describe as, in, you know, why is there this barrier between man? Why can't you civilize him if he is mentally capable? Well, it's because of this, it's because of what he had done in the past. But that kind of knowledge wasn't really preserved in historical records. It was passed down through the trauma that this nuclear war caused. It was passed down like through myth. Like the memory of that trauma was preserved through traditional wisdom, not really through historical documentation.
Yes. So the orangutans, like their intellectual class, have decided to invent a noble lie, the noble myth, where for the greater good of their society, they've sort of embellished the past and come up with some things which may not be true, but it is for the greater good. And this is a very interesting thing. And for us, that seems totally heretical. It seems like the dishonesty about it straight away. But you have to ask yourself, like, right, why not? I mean, I can think of some other modern myths of the Western world which is absolutely forbidden to go sort of poking around in. And because I'm treading on eggshells again, like, but basically you can look at the paradigm since World War II, and you can have a look at how morality was constructed. And that's why it's off limits. You're not allowed to talk about that. You're not allowed to question that, because when you begin pulling at that thread, the whole jumper, the whole jumper will start coming down. And this is what they understand. But that is a purely negative one. But it's also possible to have a situation where it's actually for the greater good. It's for the greater good that you tell a noble lie to the population. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I used to watch this and used to think, wow, that their little village, their town that they've built, it's so barbaric and horrible. But the fact is, among themselves, it's okay. It does look quite peaceful. I would probably rather live in that ape village than I would rather live in London or New York. Then there's a bit of bait there for the chat. Don't.
Yeah. Well, one thing you could look at in real history was something like Darwinism. You know, so now, first of all, Darwinism from today's standards is actually like deeply right wing if you actually want to apply it to modern human society. But not going down that route. If you want to look at like what Darwinism kind of did to Christianity, why was it like so suppressed back then? It's that, you know, it kind of now, you know, I'm still a Christian. I do believe that. I do believe in God but something like Darwinism can be kind of a dagger against that. It shows, well, you know, evolution, you know, maybe God didn't create the earth in 7 days. Man wasn't really created by him in his image and stuff like that. So you can argue that, well, we can't possibly suppress this because it's the truth. But then, you know, what are the effects? What have been the effects of kind of a Western man losing his religiosity? Would it have just been better if that was just never discovered at all? And kind of, you know, I know that I don't think that was the sole reason why we lost religion in the West. But just using this as an example, could you make the argument that if we look at, you know, the societal decay that's been left in the void once we lost Christianity, if suppressing different scientific truths back, you know, 150 years ago, if that could have prevented that, would it have been justified? And I'm not going to like go back on that very, like, you know, that minefield we were on earlier, but, you know, from the perspective of certain people, you know, yes, today suppressing certain truths is worth it for them, you know, for certain groups of people. It is actually 100% worth it to suppress certain truths from getting out if it allows them to maintain their power, which the only problem is that it isn't, it's their power versus ours. So.
Yeah,
it's a question.
So the Dr. Zeus's sort of attitude towards the chimpanzees, and in the next movie, they've actually got chimpanzees who are protesting like a bunch of like hippies against the impending war. So you can see what they had in mind there. But he can understand that they're. Like he knows that they're going to unravel the whole society. Like they do need to be chastised and they do need to be warned against it. Whereas in our society, they were given free rein. They just went completely berserk and deconstructed everything. Because you can break anything apart. But what you'll find is that once you're in the position of power, you just don't allow it. You don't allow your narratives, meta-narratives, to be questioned and undermined that way. So because like you don't like move on to a greater truth. You can look at the madhouse of the world today and think, well, I mean, funny enough, like science is now being like seen as a religion which you can't question. People now get censored for questioning science.
Yeah, and just imagine though, like you know, some of the things that we'll talk about in our spheres, certain truths that you can't mention on YouTube. Just imagine what it would be like for the elites today if that came out, if they had to admit, yeah, you know, the stuff that we've been pursuing since World War II, it's all been a lie. It's been based on incorrect information. And we've kind of been lying to you in order to uphold our own power. I mean, if that got out, like, you know, it's basically good night for this set of elites. So they will do whatever they can to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, I mean, there's a secondary kind of layer to this as well, I think, which is that the humans are that they're part of the ape wider sort of world, and they've amassed all of this technology and all of these obviously world-ending powerful weapons, But at the end of the day, they've still remained like a primitive, barbaric people. So you have, you know, I think this is another clever thing they have done, where because your knee jerk reaction is to think, well, their society is primitive and they are all barbaric, and they have deliberately made it so that they're actually not like that. They're like that to the humans, but not to each other. And the whole point of it is that the humans are like that towards each other. And yet, but the problem is the humans have managed to get to the point where they've got nuclear bombs and they can go into space and do all of this stuff. But that basic, like, sort of barbarism, savagery, is still there. They never got rid of it. And in the end, it's why humanity was wiped out. And I mean, one thing I do like about this one, which one of the things, like, I mean, in the most recent reboot of Planet of the Apes, this stream's just a constant minefield. Like, I will say that, but it's like every direction that I go, it just says channel ban. But in the recent reboot, the reason why the human race died out wasn't a nuclear bomb; it was because of a virus, and they were doing tests on the apes. And you got super intelligent apes, which eventually kind of took over from mankind. But what I don't like about that is that they've had to invent that as a way to give them intelligence. And I prefer it like Planet of the Apes, where it's like they just kind of filled the gap. They just sort of, the original, the Charlton Heston one, it seems more like they just filled the gap that was left by the humans. And they stepped into the wreckage and took over, rather than having it where it's because of humans that they became so intelligent. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it was just already there. It's just that there was this kind of specter of man's power reigning over them. And that was what the ape elite were so afraid of. There's a line toward the end when Charlton Heston is riding off with Nova, and you know he has the rifle that they took from the apes, and he says to Dr. Zaius, "Don't try to follow me. I'm pretty handy with one of these." And Dr. Zaius replies, "I am quite sure that's true," or something like that, to that effect. Meaning, yeah, he knows that man is good at killing people. It's basically all that he does. I thought that was really clever. But you know, one thing I thought of with the scene of the trial. So the trial where they're debating whether or not Taylor is intelligent. What kind of creature is he? And it's based on, I'm sure it's based on the Scopes monkey trial or something like that. If anyone doesn't know, that's from a trial in the 1920s against a teacher in Tennessee who illegally taught evolution in his classroom. And there was this big row over it made national news and stuff like that about evolution being taught in the classroom versus kind of the old religious traditions that people in Tennessee believed. But anyway, one thing I thought of with that scene is I could kind of imagine, like, that's how the debate at the time of this movie came out. That's kind of how it went with several different things that like, for example, like, let's say, like, homosexuality, for example, in the late 1960s, you probably would have had these liberal activists and, you know, putting aside all the subversion, putting aside, you know, the hostile groups who had different things in mind. Let's just say, you know, it's like this, your average white liberal from the 60s, let's say. You know, they might be making arguments. Well, you know, well, why is it bad? Well, why is it wrong to... Why is this considered wrong? What's wrong with men? Well, they didn't have marriage back then, but why is it something that we're so against in our society? Why do we actually have laws against it? And a lot of the replies would have probably sounded a lot like Dr. Zaius and the religious tribunal in Planet of the Apes. They said, well, it's against our scripture, you know, our Christian traditions say this. You know, we have the Book of Leviticus and you know, some of the writings of the Apostle Paul, and well, it's against the will of God. And that argument didn't hold up, as we can see by the world today over the last few decades. But you know, I guarantee you though that any like normal liberal who wasn't like hell bent on societal destruction back in the 60s, if they could see what was happening today with like the transgender children and all this stuff, none of them would support that. They'd be horrified by that. And, you know, they would think twice if they could see that this is going to be the end result of what they're pushing for, you know, 50 years ago. But, you know, what we had back then was we didn't have kind of this like scientific argument against it, though I would say a lot of the argument, the, you know, so-called science that's been used to push that is rubbish science. But nonetheless, they were relying on some kind of traditional wisdom. It was a Chestertonian fence. You know, it was a fence that was passed down through tradition, you know, because back in the alternative hypothesis made this great point in a video that in like, let's say the in old Mesopotamia or in the Levant, like 3000 years ago or something, you'd have like a tribe who forbid homosexuality and a tribe who permit it. And now someone could say, well, why are they forbidding it? It's based on their superstitions. It's bigotry, or, you know, it's hatred, as they would say today. But the reality was back then that the tribe who forbid it would outcompete the tribe that allowed it. And, you know, you can even apply certain scientific, you can apply certain scientific rationale to that today. It's dysgenic. You can look at things like Darwinism. But you see, they didn't rely on that kind of thinking. It was just kind of this traditional knowledge that they had. And oftentimes that actually does result in more wisdom than really kind of the Enlightenment empiricism that, you know, somewhat that the liberals in the 1960s would have been relying on, and characters like Cornelius and Zero were relying on. I thought of a great meme that you could make with Planet of the Apes. You have the IQ bell curve, you know, where the idiot on the far left side and the idiot on the far right side, who have like the extremely low IQ and the extremely high IQ, they agree with each other. Then the midwit, who's at the very average, he has like he's the one who's the real idiot. He has the dumb idea. You could apply this to Planet of the Apes, whereas you'd have the gorillas on the left, and all they'd say is "man bad, ape good," and then you'd have the chimpanzees in the middle saying "man is an intelligent creature who can be civilized just like us," and then you'd have Dr. Zaius and the orangutans on the right hand side saying "man is the pawn of the devil."
Yeah, it really is like that meme. It really is like that meme. It's interesting because in the other ones, the more recent reboots and remakes, they bring forward, you'll notice there isn't like a great leader in this one. It's more like just a community with a community elder or something. But it's very idyllic. But in the other ones, they tend to have this great Caesar leader in it. I noticed they didn't mention him at all in this in the first one. That's most come in the later ones, because they made like how many, four after this. I watched the second one last night. I think it's like five original Planet of the Apes movies, and the Zira and Roddy McDowall in the later one, they all get worse because the budgets got smaller and smaller, so the ape makeup keep getting worse. And if you look at even in the like it's in the Charlton Heston one, it's really well done. But then as they got like worse and worse as it went on, the makeup just looked absolutely terrible. And you can see it in the extras on the second movies, like when there's a big speech about war and invading the Forbidden Zone. And you just look at the sort of extras in the background, and their makeup is absolutely, it really does just like look like somebody's just bought it out of a toy shop or something. Just blank open mouths sort of expressions on their faces and all this. So the Caesar figure, I thought he would get a mention, but he doesn't get a mention whatsoever. And I think they bring him in a later episode, and then in the more modern reboots, he is like literally like this big Caesar, you know, the leader, that he becomes this mythologized great leader that led the apes to like freedom away from the slavery and conquered the humans in open battle. Like, again, I always found that was a bit kind of naff. And I like the idea that they just stepped into the vacuum that was created by the humans.
Yeah, one thing, I did see the second one. I will say it was not that great. I've only seen the first two. But yeah, at the end of the second one, you know, I know, spoilers, we don't really shy away from those on the stream. With like his dying, with his dying breaths, Charlton Heston actually blows up the planet. with a nuclear bomb that was left over from when humanity was still walking the earth. And you know, it does. It's also interesting that why would he do that? You know, because under the apes logic, that would be like completely that would be like completely unthinkable. Because like, if you're just about to die, are you going to bring down all of life on Earth with you? Maybe it's a good commentary on the Cold War that, you know, you're creating all these weapons which have the potential to end human life on Earth. You know, are you someone who's like who's so vengeful that you would actually do that, really?
Yeah. I think it's to say. I don't think that made much sense at the end of that one, but I think it is kind of just hammering the point home that they will just blow everybody up if it's mutually assured destruction again. I mean, one of the things that's worth pointing about is just how insane it is that the mutually assured destruction of the Cold War, because let's just go with the mainstream sort of normie narrative and the idea that you would, and in the, you know, if you go along with this stuff, I'm kind of on the, because a lot of people will get into this and they'll say it was all just like a big hoax. I tend to come down on the side of the discussion who says that it was actually for real, because Joseph Stalin went AWOL on the string pullers, the New World Order crowd, the elites, that Stalin kind of went a little bit rogue on them. And it's something that people debate and argue about. This is based on Kerry Bolton's work. And he makes a very strong case that Stalin was completely out of control and that they really wanted Trotsky in there. But leaving that aside, what you end up with is the world being divided into two camps and bringing all of humanity to the brink of the end, the complete end. And for what? In the end, it's an argument about materialism. It's an whether it's capitalism or communism, it's just a dispute over how you should carve up the resources and how you should sort of make a society function. But it does come down to just materialism and money, and which system is the best for that. So if you are living in a part of the world which was like deeply spiritual and uninterested in the argument, you can kind of make the case that they were barbaric and stupid for that. Like, it wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, that the reason for the Cold War, the reason for that kind of, that tension was completely retarded at the end of the day. Just an argument about stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, a lot of us today, we used to say the phrase like cultural Marxism or something like that to describe the crazy like SJW stuff that's going on. And, you know, someone like Keith Woods would probably push back and say, well, it's really more just cultural capitalism. And I think that what the real question is, though, is that the height of human ambition? Is it just getting more stuff? Is it just this argument between what's going to get us more stuff, communism or capitalism? And, you know, it really, when you look at it like that, it is really kind of shallow, because, you know, you have on one hand this the Soviet Union, so an egalitarian so-called workers' paradise, which is really just a one-party state run with a state-planned economy. And then you have what's developed into Globo Homo today. So you have America, which is, you know, and over the course of the Cold War, is increasingly becoming secular, consumeristic. They were spreading things like McDonald's to the world. And yeah, like, you know, it does, because, you know, when I think of a lot of other wars, you know, you think of something like the Crusades, the men who were fighting in those wars, they truly deeply believed that they were on a mission from God, that it was something spiritual, it was something eternal that they were fighting over. Whereas with the Cold War, you know, one thing, like the stakes were a lot higher, but I kind of just find it as not as interesting, just for the fact that, you know, it ultimately was just a fight over stuff, really.
Yeah, it's completely shallow. From the point of view of Dr. Zeus, you can see, like, it is ridiculous. And his society would be fit to just stay like that for thousands and thousands of years. And this is how, like, sort of reactionary I've become, where I'm, because when we're in the West, I sometimes look at pictures, like, say, like a farmer from Uzbekistan or something, or, you know, like a farmer from who works the land in Siberia, some little place out of the way, and I wonder to myself, like, their life must be so settled. Like, generations and generations will pass, and change is like, it's almost like this static life. And this is actually, I think this is actually the human norm around the world. Like, if it wasn't for Western technology and, you know, global homo forcing itself on everywhere. But people by and large will just live out their lives on the land like that quite happily. And I think, why is it that we in the West, why is it that I've never known what's like that? In living in the West, it's like you've been stuck on this crazy train ride. Like, just look how quickly things change. Just look how quickly things have changed in the last 5 years. Why is it that it's like that with us, you know? And so you can make a fair critique that you are hurtling towards the unknown, and that the problems which are stacking up because of this, because of this never-ending progression, it is going to hit you hard. Now, in the 60s and 70s, you know, we did already come to, like, the end of the world with nuclear bombs, and now you see other things coming in, you see other threats. So it's as if we're always trying to, like, keep so many plates in the air, and with each passing decade, like, there's more plates being thrown in that we've got to keep up in the air, juggle. And I think, like, what's the point of it all? When you could just live on happily on the land, and most of it's just buying junk and consumerism, and then you get these, like, progressive politics which go along with it, which is really, this is where I totally agree with Keith Woods. It really is just a way to sort of make people want to buy more stuff. It's just sort of perfecting the consumer mentality. And I think to myself, like, it would be better if you could kind of just step outside of history. Because, I mean, you were mentioning Spengler, and he talks about that the very sort of late stage of a civilization, you will get the fellaheen who just go back to the land. And they, as he would put it, they step outside of history. History and the flow of time in that way has just stops for them, and they too will go into, you know, you imagine somebody in rural Chile and all of these places where not much happens, and they just live happily and content. They've got a feeling of, like, being on the land. And this is the difference as well between, in Planet of the Apes, what the apes have built compared to the humans. And so you ask yourself, why can't we just live settled, sane lives? Why are we on this roller coaster all of the time when it isn't actually everybody in the world, you know? I mean, it does have a habit of forcing itself on everybody, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I actually met someone who pretty much fits the description that you gave. It wasn't in Siberia, but it was in Russia. I visited a Russian village last year, and this was during the height of the, well, you know what the big event during last year. Actually, it was in June last year, so this was just after the what do we call it, the illness became a thing. And this was just, and this was as these riots were happening in America last year. And I visited this Russian village which was a couple of hundred kilometers away from St. Petersburg. And there was a farm on the village, and you could just walk across the fields. Because I knew a friend, I had a friend who lived in that village. I went to visit them because I was just sick of being in the city for that whole fiasco with the lockdowns and stuff. But anyway, there was this Russian guy who was, he must have been in his, I'd say mid-50s maybe. And he was working on this field. He had a bunch of cows, and he was just taking the cows out to pasture in the morning. So it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. He had already had a bit of vodka that morning. But I just loved the guy so much. Like, I'm sure I was probably the first non-Russian that he ever met in his entire life. Because he even said that he had spent his entire life within this like small area, within the small village. And I just thought, like, you know, what's going on in the world right now? You know, they have all these crazy new restrictions on what you can do with your time in America. They're currently saying that, you know, you're scum of the earth for being white. And I just thought, this guy has never interacted with any of that in his entire life. You know, his day probably includes him waking up at, like, I don't know, probably not very early, taking the cows out for a few hours, maybe having a shot of vodka in the morning to prepare himself for work. And then coming back and then, you know, maybe reminiscing with all the old babushkas about the Soviet years. And, you know, I think that he probably has it a lot better than almost everyone in the West. I mean, he'd be like dirt poor compared to, you know, any person living in somewhere like London or New York today. But I'm sure he probably has a lot more fulfilling life than any of us do.
So somebody sent in, bought me a coffee and asked a question, which is the only one so far. So thanks a lot for that. It says, Ordox Law, can you guys talk more about Nova? What made her attractive, her femininity and everything? So I think it's funny because it kind of touches on what we're talking about. And I think why that she is erotic and why, like, it's the way Charlton Heston treats her as well. It strips away all of modernity, and you get back down to the very basics of life, which is a man and a woman on the land having to survive as in a partnership. So all of the politics, all of the economics, all of the grand systems, you know, the capitalism versus communism, all of the ideologies, all of this rubbish, because it is just rubbish at the end of the day. It's what this is, like, the modernity forcing itself on us, and like you know, this thing where you're thrown into the world and you've got to deal with all of this. And what you see there is all of that stuff is kind of being thrown out, and what you're left with is like a healthy masculine man and a gorgeous, who's actually like half of his age as well, in reality. I looked it up. She's one of the very few who's still alive, and she's like 76. So she would have been about 24 when she would have been in her early 20s when Planet of the Apes was made, and Charlton Heston was kicking on 50. So he's done all right for himself. he's just like a total Chad in all ways in this movie. But there is what you see with Nova, I think, is almost like a primordial femininity, you know, where she can't. I mean, I know it seems a little bit, you know, too much to say. It's nice that she can't speak, but like, you've got to admit, it's like she doesn't have an attitude, and she's loyal, and this is important. She gets taken care of by Taylor, like that. That's key. He does actually care about her. So he's a really deeply cynical kind of bloke. You know, I've said he's a bastard in his own right, but he does care about Nova, and she's earned it. And what they've done is go back to this really primordial, almost like the kind of thing that Julius Evolau might get into, where you're just left with the raw masculinity and the raw femininity. You haven't got all of this gray zone anymore, where nobody knows what's what and nobody knows who should play what role and all of this crap that comes with modernity. So they've been reduced almost like to their primal identities. And that's why I think she's so alluring in that movie.
Yeah, and she's kind of like an Eve figure, you know, Adam and Eve. It's just kind of man's first desire. It's very primal. So, yeah, definitely. Do you think that what was her ethnic background? Was she Italian?
I don't know either.
But another thing I wanted to touch on, though, was the theme of power and of loss of power and of subjugation. Now, you know, we don't need to get too much into the issue of race here, but you know, it is relevant though. you know, so as I mentioned at the beginning of the movie, Taylor is, you know, the alpha Chad from the greatest power on Earth at the time. He's so confident that he's like really just cynical about it. He really can't imagine ever a world where he really isn't the Chad. But then when he finds himself in the Planet of the Apes, he finds himself literally reduced to an animal in a cage. And, you know, it's very emblematic of the loss of power. And, you know, I think the reaction of someone like of the character of Taylor when he's thrown in the cage, or even like the first part where they're being chased like animals, you know, they're intelligent and the rest of the humans aren't. But when the apes come rolling around, they're running for their lives just like everyone else. You know, I thought it was interesting how the three astronauts, you know, one of them dies, one of them's lobotomized later, how they're like just running for their lives just like the rest of the apes. It really, like, he's really cut down to size in that scene alone. Like, you know, when he's put in a cage like an animal, and they put a leash on him everywhere they go. I mean, it's really like really emasculating for someone who is just so used to being the alpha Chad. And, you know, I do feel like a lot of people in the West, you know, maybe we're realizing this, but are going to really have a rude awakening very shortly based on things that are happening. Now, there's things like, there's the demographic issue, but there's also things like the, let's just call it the reboot that's going on right now. Like, we're going to find ourselves in a situation. We've been so complacent for so long because, you know, no one in the West is used to living in a world where we aren't on top. It's almost like something that we can't even imagine, like with the amount of comfort and stability that we've had for so long. But, you know, what we're really seeing in the world is that very quickly, you can look at the certain campaigns that are going on now, certain mandates, not to get into those, but people are starting to realize that we actually kind of are vulnerable. There was a great meme that I shared on my Telegram, that it was a picture of Taylor, so Charlton Heston, being strangled by the two apes when they're, like, you know, trying to get him on a leash to pull him out of the cage. And the caption of the meme was, well, at least I still have the Constitution. And that's really what's going on with us today. You know, it really shows what losing power is really like.
Yeah, it is. And he does kind of take it well, though. I mean, he's never bowed at all. Whether other people can handle that, I don't know. I mean, he does get to sort of ride off into the wilderness as well at the end. I mean, we should say that it does have one of the most iconic science fiction endings of all science fiction movies. In the one that came after this, they tried to top it, and they showed like all of New York with the underground and everything. It was this matte painting. So when they talk about the Forbidden Zone, in the second one, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, that's expanded upon, and it is actually all of New York. With like wrecked skyscrapers and stuff. It does, you know, they didn't have much of a budget, and it's not the greatest special effect, but you can see what they're getting at. So that means that if one of the apes, and you know, it is important to say, like, this is the movie that came second. They did kind of bolt it on there, and I think it's not as good. Because I think it's better when it is like just really desolate, because, you know, New York is cold and yet here it's desert. Where was it, like Arizona or Nevada?
Yeah, I did think of that. I thought, you know, it did cross my mind, like, you know, would New York really look like this? I know it was like a nuclear war or something, but, you know, just for the shot of the Statue of Liberty alone, that it was worth it, I thought, because that's like just so iconic, and it just like would be such a punch to the gut of any American in the 1960s to just see the Statue of Liberty like that, like reduced to some kind of ancient, forgotten about ruins.
Yeah, and it's because it's such an iconic thing to see it buried in the sand like that. I think it has it leaves an impression on you, because you realize that your civilization can come to an end. And when it does, it'll be sort of like that eventually. I mean, it kind of leads me on to sort of something else that what you see here is a sort of cyclical view of history, and which ties in with Spengler. But I love science fiction where So I was talking before about like the sort of liberal progression, technology, consumerism, all of these things of the modern world. And it does get ever more liberal because the society becomes ever softer. And you can see as you, the things that you were alluding to before, you know, you look at the social credit systems coming in and all this, it does lead where you are just this passive sheep-like creature who's going into the you know, into the control system. And you don't even, your sort of senses. Why is it that some people like me are like completely paranoid about this stuff and other people just aren't? And I think, you know, that in the end, their way of detecting danger, you know, like this really good thing. We were talking about Nova in a skimpy little bikini and stuff being this primal thing. Another primal thing is having like some sort of intuition where you can detect danger. You can you may not have all of the data. You may not have all of the facts, but there's something in your gut saying danger, beware, don't go along with this. And yet today, like massive amount of people just seem to have lost that completely when it comes from the authority. So it leads to this passivity, which is deadly. And what I like about this kind of science fiction is that you can look back. They're looking, so you get to look back on progressivism as something which happened in the ancient past, because for us it's always in the future. Things are always getting better. Things are always improving. We're always 1 year closer to the future of Star Trek. Whereas you look at something like Dune or Planet of the Apes or Warhammer and all of this, and you can see that they look back. Like the progressive future is something which is ancient history to them. And instead, they've gone back to this more primitive and, I would say, healthy way of life.
And also, when you look back at it, it just shows how insane the progressivism really was. So in the case of Planet of the Apes, like we were mentioning earlier, someone like Dr. Zaius looks back on inventions of nuclear weapons and things like that, and man's ability to kill another man. He thinks that's just outright insanity. It's just complete lunacy. But, you know, you can think of someone in the 20th century as seeing that as progress. So, you know, they see that they're constantly progressing towards a better future. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that whoever picks up the ashes of whatever ends up happening to the West today, they're going to look back at this era and it's going to look like absolute insanity. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, for the people who are actually living through it, oftentimes it's really hard to see. But then when you kind of zoom out and you look at it through like a Spenglerian civilizational cycle, you look at it through that lens, it really kind of just shows how just ludicrous all of it really is. You know, you can not like there's all the SJW stuff, but there's also even like this new technocracy that's coming in. And you know, I've always thought, you know, it's going to be really interesting once this kind of current regime ends. It's really going to be interesting. I don't know if we're going to live to see it, but seeing how future historians write about it, that's something that I'm really interested in finding out. You know, hopefully it's going to be our guys, our descendants in the future, but you know, even like how the Chinese are going to write about it, it's going to be fascinating.
What's so people will say like a sort of cyclical view of history, because you know that is kind of what Planet of the Apes is. They will say that it's too blackpilling, because they will say that means that things are only ever going to get worse. But the problem is, it's a cycle. So it depends where you are on that cycle and what you think of as being worse. So if you think in that way, what we're going through now is something to be endured and survived, so that you can get to the, you know, back to the more basic primitive pre-culture phase after it all collapses. So in the here and now, it is quite bleak. But in long term, you get to look back. Well, we won't, but people will look back on the era of liberalism and progressivism in a past tense, as if it was some crazy like completely insane phase that a civilization went through before it just collapsed in on itself and went into meltdown and couldn't function anymore because the people were too stupid to figure out how to run the AI systems and all of the rest of it. I mean, look, just look at the logistics of the nuclear power station. Like, look at the demographics. Look at the people who created and designed nuclear power stations in the 1950s, the 1960s. How much of that, you're talking about very, very high IQ European men. So is that going to be possible in the future? Well, to be honest, it doesn't look like that. So what happens, who is going to maintain a nuclear power station? Who is going to maintain nuclear arsenals? You know, I mean, in my opinion, we should start breaking all of that shit apart straight away. Otherwise, what will happen is that you'll get more things like Chernobyl because there's going to be more scope and less competence. People that won't be able to maintain it because you just won't have the stock anymore. So that's things people. But the problem is the progressive mindset of the standard shit libs who run the Western world today, they wouldn't dream of that precisely because they think things are always going to get better. I was looking at a blog post. I was putting together something for another video, and it was the grim dark kind of stuff that I was looking at for some artwork, and I came across a blog post and there was a guy who he's into like sort of dystopian futures, and this one was about, the article was about Blade Runner 2049, and the feminist and social justice warriors had complained about how females were objectified in Blade Runner 2049. I mean, just as a side note here, I thought that was complete garbage. I mean, I do like that movie, but like at the end of the day, there's only really one male character in it, and every other main character in it is female. The good, but whether they're good, like Joy or bad, it's just females completely dominate the storyline and the characters. But leaving that aside, his response was an interesting one. Because he responded to these sort of SJW types, Blade Runner 2049 is a dystopia. Like, why do you think that your politics exists in a dystopia? Or to put it this way, why can't you envision, even in dystopian terms, the idea that in the future there would no longer be equality? Or that in the future, in this horror version of the future, women wouldn't be treated well. So the point of it is that even when they can't actually come up, and I thought it was a really interesting point, that these SJW liberal shitlib types, they'll come up with a vision of the future which is dystopian. But they won't actually depict like a sort of far right one. What they'll still need to have diversity quotas in there. They'll still need to have feminism in there and all of this kind of thing. So the idea that there's this dark vision of the future, which doesn't feature any of you, they just can't do it. They literally just can't comprehend that. I thought that was fascinating because they can't even, you know, why don't they make in Hollywood far-right visions of the future? Well, in 100 years' time, the far-right have taken over and they've done all of these terrible things. And then they, like, depict where everybody's white and everybody, like, it's sort of, like, returned to tradition and all of this. Because from that point, from their point of view, it would be, like, dystopian. But they won't go there. They wouldn't allow that to be made. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, you know, like you can look at the Star Wars movies, which everyone has talked about to death. But, you know, there's the scenes in the first one. And like, by the way, this does just show how little creativity they had, that like there's the blonde haired, blue eyed guy ranting in front of a bunch of red banners with circular emblems on them. The stormtroopers all standing in formation. and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, I will say, like, gee, I wonder what that was meant to be alluding to. But even then, like, you can see, though, in this Star Wars one, like, they have diversity in all the soldiers. So even they still have the First Order still has, like, diversity and feminism and all that stuff. The other example could be, though, that, you know, with the shitlib SJW types, the only real dystopia that they can envision that isn't theirs is, like, one that's a dystopia because it's not controlled by them. So you can look at something like, I haven't watched this, but something like The Handmaid's Tale. And with something like that, it's also really shallow because it still runs based on all the assumptions that their worldview is with all the assumptions that their worldview is based on. It's just saying that, well, it's a dystopia because it's not progressive. It's a dystopia because it doesn't have feminism or something like that. It's really, like, kind of shallow. And I guess it's just the fish not knowing that it's swimming in water, really. Like, when a fish never realizes what water is because it's so used to swimming in water that it can't really envision anything else that exists. I mean, I guess if you want to flip that on its head, like, would they have ever thought to make a dystopian movie back in the 1950s where all, like, you know, crazy, like, LGBT women and all these crazy, like, minorities and stuff like that, where they're all controlling everything? And I don't know, would they have ever even thought of making that? I mean, I think that their dystopias honestly kind of seem like a paradise compared to what the West is actually becoming today.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of things that popped up in the 90s, I think, when people like Demolition Man, which everybody tells me to, like, do a video on. I'd have to watch it again. But that is, like, this sort of, you know, soft, shitlib, politically correct future that got parried. So it was as if there was a, like, some people saw the writing on the wall. I mean, the same as Wall-E that you did a video on as well, you know. That's actually quite a grim vision of the future. But because it's so soft, I think the message was lost on a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the one other thing that I had written about in my notes was that it's kind of like the red pill, as we call it, kind of the person who's awake to it all. So, you know, you're living through a nightmare and no one even sees it. And, you know, I'm pretty sure everyone listening to this probably knows what that's like on any given issue that we're facing today. And I kind of thought that the character of Taylor kind of is like someone going through the West today who is, you know, red pilled, so to say. He realizes what's going, he realizes that, you know, they're now being treated like they're now lower than animals. They're being locked in cages and stuff like that. But he knows that, humans are intelligent and they're actually capable of building a civilization of their own. And, he's just kind of being strung along for the, ride because, kind of like I mentioned earlier, they don't have power. He's lost power and he's been reduced to, this, like, lower than low status. And, you know, I think that, it is very emblematic of, you know, trying to convince, you know, people in your life today of, you know, the various issues that we spend our time discussing. Because, you know, if you look at the humans in the film, they're lamb to the slaughter. They're just waiting around the fields. And then as soon as the apes come, then they just run for their lives, just like, you know, scared sheep or something like that.
They're actually like the Eloi from H.G. Wells. I never thought of that before, but they're so passive that it's a kind of like the I don't know if this inspired it. I know there was a book written that it was based on, which is slightly different, which I was looking up last night. But in H.G. Wells' Time Machine, again, like, when you look in the far future, you've got the Eloi and the Morlocks, and you did, like, so it was once one humanity, but then over time, and in it, for H.G. Wells, it was class. Like, class became the evolutionary pressure which splintered the two. So the kind of the bourgeoisie would become too soft and kind of cattle-like with all of their luxuries, and that they would become the Eloi, And then, like, the working class proles would descend down into these, like, scavenging monsters and that kind of thing. And that's actually kind of, there's some of that in Planet of the Apes as well. I mean, when you look at what's happening in the West today, I put this on Telegram a few weeks ago, that when you look at what's being done in the West, you see more and more a divergence. You see more and more people saying, well, I'm going to head off into the woods. I'm doing prepping. I'm checking out. I'm not going to pay tax and all of this. And I'm heading off just to live off grid. This is becoming more and more thing. And it's really gathering pace now. And then you've got other people who are, I'm going to be hooked up to the AI. I'm going to have all of these digital implants. I'm going to get chips in my hands and be monitored 24-hour a day. So while the others are out there scratching on the earth and like barbecuing rats and all of this, so you can kind of see that pressure being applied there, where eventually you're going to have like two completely different sets of people.
Yeah, you know, you can even think of this, the character of Taylor, Charlton Heston's character, that you know, if you actually just wanted to not be killed, he should just be quiet, and then the humans would just treat him like any other animal. Much like how the elites today view people who are, you know, woken up to what's going on. They view them as like public enemy number one. So, you know, that could be people like us, or it could be, you know, various other figures who, not to overstate our personal importance, but you get the idea though. Like, you can look at what's happening in America right now. They're saying that like parents who protest the curriculum being taught to their children at school are terrorists. Like, it's really getting quite extreme. And you can look at a character like Charlton Heston, and he's the one who actually is like standing up against this kind of new helplessness that the humans have found themselves in. You know, I think that like what's happening today is that I think our comfort is like quickly evaporating. People are realizing that, their way of life, the wealth that they had in previous decades is going away very quickly. But the problem is that they're just so complacent now that they've really lost all agency. So, you know, just to get that, you know, those bug burgers and their universal income and their, matchbox size apartment, they're going to go and get their medication, let's just say. They're going to go get that every 6 months and they're just going to go along with it. And the people who are punished are the ones who don't go along with that. So, you know, that would be the character of Taylor in this film. But then, like you mentioned earlier, though, he is the character that you really respect. You know, he goes through all this hell throughout the film, but you know, he just still remains like a Chad. Like, even when he's being put onto a leash and being like dragged around, put in cages and stuff like that, degraded, he still does kind of seem as someone who you actually really can respect. And I guess what my final thoughts would be is that in the society that we live in today, you can kind of be like that by being the one who just says no to what's going on. And it's not going to be pleasant for you. It's going to be quite rough. I mean, what's going to happen is, first of all, you're going to be denied basically every public service imaginable for not, getting your medication, let's just say. And I mean, it's not going to be easy, but ultimately that is the kind of the man that everyone respects. That is the kind of the person who actually maintains their agency. And I think that's kind of the way that you have to go about the world that we're living in.
When Taylor and the other two astronauts first come across all of the primitive humans running around, he actually says, if this is the best they've got, we're going to be kings within 2 weeks. Like, as soon as he looks at them, he's like, yeah, I'm going to rule. I'm going to take it over. Of course, there's another bunch of people there, you know. But he's got that drive in him straight away to dominate and to look at the primitive humans and think, yeah, I'm going to be at the top of this food chain, no problem. And that gets back to what you were saying on power. You know, of course, when the apes turn up, it's not the case at all. He's going to be right at the bottom. And it's interesting that they've got breeding and things, but they do say they're going to castrate him. He's going to be gelded. So it's kind of like because he is different to all of the other humans. And it's like when what a farmer would do, where in the where the bull, which is the like hard work, the bull, which is the most aggressive, that's the one that gets castrated because you want the more passive ones to breed. So it's as if they understand that about Charlton Heston. You can't allow him to go on, you know.
Yeah, but even like from his perspective, Dr. Zayers might hate his guts. He might think he's like a menace and everything like that. But I mean, in contrast, what do you think he thinks of the other humans? I mean, they're just like, yeah, they're just cattle really to him. And, you know, yeah, Taylor, the one who actually stands up to it all, he's the one that actually he's a real shock to the system. So,
and you know, he's got him. I mean, he will shoot him as well. Like when they're in the cave and he's got that rifle, He shoots a couple of the apes, and you know, he even like the Cornelius has brought his young nephew along for the ride, and Taylor even shoves the gun in his face. he's totally willing to just blow people away, and eventually Dr. Zeus is like chained, like tied up, and he deliberately puts it around his neck, and it's so. It's like so disrespectful to their, you know, their elder and their leader. And then he just rides off. And like the bit that you see when he says, "Don't follow me because I'm handy with this." And he's got like a role the person they respect most. And it is this commentary, like, yeah, don't mess around with the Chad Heston there, because he will just shoot you, or he'll tell you to shut up, or smack you in the mouth. And if you're a sexy young bit fluff, he'll throw you up onto his horse and ride off into the sunset with you. Cracking stuff. Absolutely cracking stuff.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So, anything else?
That's pretty much it. I've got... I'd just like to say thank you very much to Wonder and Will, who bought me 5 beers. And then there's Paul Wooten, who spent $5. Thank you very much. But that's kind of it. What we got there? Let's have a look. Quick look at the chat there. It's gone. I saw someone had us highlighted, and then it's gone again. But what are we doing next time?
I haven't decided yet. If we decide to squeeze one in before Halloween, maybe we could do some kind of horror movie, some gothic movie, maybe Night of the Hunter. That might be a possibility. Other than that, I'll have to think on it. Haven't decided yet, but I'm sure we'll get it. We'll come up with a good idea.
Right. Well, I think that's, I hope you've enjoyed that for another cozy Sunday there. And, we'll be back next time. So thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for the super chats and the coffees. And I'll catch you all later.